and welcome to Alliance Manchester Business School's Original Thinking Podcast. Today's podcast was recorded at our latest Vital Topics event, sponsored by DWF. Vital Topics is Alliance MBS's flagship event series. The series has brought powerful ideas and original thinking to audiences from the Manchester City region and beyond since it first launched in 1972.
It's been a pleasure to invite you here today and to see so many of you. When we started talking about recovery, renewal, resilience, this was a number of years ago when the pandemic started. And it involved us working with Greater Manchester Resilience Forum in those initial days when it was clear that something different was happening in the UK. And so one of the speakers, Cathy Oldham, Chief Resilience Officer, invited us to come and to learn a little bit about what GM was doing. And being academics, we were sitting there listening to the conversation, and Cathy turned to us and said, "What's going on internationally? Can you find out a little bit about what's going on, and can you bring those lessons to GM?" And that question, or that invitation, led to 2 years of work that involved us developing something called Manchester Briefing. So the briefing went out across the world to try and understand what other countries were doing. And we brought that together in the briefing and shared that within GM. And that first issue was circulated to 127 people. But some of the feedback that we got was quite positive. And over the course of the next couple of years, we continued developing the briefing, and eventually we were issuing it to about 65,000 people each issue, and through a whole distribution network that we formed, including the UN Resilient Cities Network and many national governments that would take out through their different mechanisms that they had. In the briefing, we started to establish this notion that recovery was absolutely critical to COVID, but that renewal was what really excited people. And from those initial conversations in GM, they were absolutely determined that the challenges that COVID had presented could only be undone by some of the really ambitious change that they wanted to see happen in their city. So we started thinking about this as renewal and started framing a process to develop the recovery and renewal that we shared through the briefing. And then we began doing further work with Essex. And this is where Andy Wright comes in, who is the lead of the recovery coordination group within Essex. And we were learning about what Essex was doing, learning about the different styles of and different challenges that they had. And we were taking all of this information and translating it into the briefing, but also translating it into this ongoing process that we were developing. At the same time, the International Standards Organization got in touch and said, "Will you develop the ISO on recovery and renewal?" So we did that. And we were constantly developing our thinking around this. And we were sharing that learning in a whole range of different ways, both in person, both online, as well as in the written word. And we ran probably about 80 to 90 webinars within an 18-month period. And through those webinars, what we're constantly trying to do was get this message of, it's not just about recovery. There's something far more ambitious there, and this is how to do it. We believe we reached about 5,000 people through those different webinars, and one person was from Ramallah City. And this was the city director of Ramallah, and they invited us to come and share some thoughts with their executive team, which is when we met the mayor, Issa. And that work led to another 18 months of development, another 18 months of involvement within Ramallah and supporting their different structures. Then we had the opportunity to visit Ramallah. We didn't have the opportunity to visit Essex, but we went to Ramallah to, I'm not saying which was better. We went to Ramallah and conducted a peer review as to how they had managed to translate the ISO that had now been published into action within Ramallah. And we were incredibly impressed by the innovation that we saw from cabinet level within Palestine, right down to businesses. And we were able to map across that whole different range of activity. Of course, this set of work has really led to this title of Recovery Renewal, because through all the conversations, whether it was within Greater Manchester, Essex, Ramallah, we understood that recovery was important. Renewal was the exciting, ambitious activity that people wanted to do. But for us, this was all taking them towards being more resilient for the next pandemic, for the next emergency that they might experience, no matter what it was, whenever it would happen. But it was all about resilience. It was all about trying to support these cities, these regions, indeed the country, to be able to protect their citizens. That then led us to start thinking about what renewal means for us. And we were working in societal resilience at the time. We were doing lots of work around volunteering. And we realized that there was a huge opportunity within the UK to take a different approach to societal resilience. And so, as Fiona said, we started a consortium with a view of taking the best lessons that we can see across the world, very much like we've done with the briefing, bringing them together and using them to do something quite different, something quite special in the UK. So we launched the consortium a year ago, and the consortium covers 97% of the UK public. We involve 50 of the 53 resilience partnerships across the UK. And what we're trying to do through that is take a completely different approach to what or how resilience partnerships can plan, how they can have a strategic approach to thinking about societal resilience, and bringing all the lessons that we've learned from our travels through GM, Essex and Ramallah to bear on those challenges. So, of course, you know, I'm standing here giving the talk, but in no way am I alone in this endeavour. We think we've probably had about 20 academics involved in this. I see Seamus here, of course, as our director of research. Aham's in the room as well, from HCRI. We've had Nat from HCRI. I'm not sure if he's here today, maybe online. We've had a whole range of co-investigators who've been involved. Some of you have met David. If you haven't met him before, then David's been at my side on absolutely every meeting I think I've been in for the last 3 years. I can't get rid of him at all. It's been an amazing effort. I see RSS represented in the room. They've been absolutely terrific. We've got marketing and comms. We've got finance. We've got really a whole business school endeavour. I see Jim over there. And there's Catherine. It has been amazing to be able to bring together everybody under this project. There are many people I will have missed, like Abby, and Andre's not here, but it has been really a privilege. And so this is almost our end event. This is where we will finish with the Recovery Renewal Project. And so I'm going to hand over to Seamus, and I'll invite the speakers to come up. And now I'm going to have a seat, and I'll hand over to you, Seamus.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Fiona, and I can forgive myself. My name is Seamus Jarvis, and I'm lecturer in marketing management and strategy. And I would like to take the opportunity to welcome all of you and those of you that are online in various platforms. And a special thanks to Kathy, Andy, and Asa for being here with us today. I'll be chairing the discussion. And I want us to start us off with something I read the other day, and it was saying that on the September 15th, the leader of the World Health Organization declared essentially that we are very close to the end of COVID. So the end is at sight, he said. And I want us to start us off, I want to start the conversation around recovery and ask you, with your personal experience in mind, where do we stand? Are we back to business as usual? Andy, you want to kick us off?
Yeah, by all means. Hello, everybody. Just to put things in context, when COVID hit, I was chief executive of a district council in of Braintree, which is in North Essex, 150,000 population, with 500 staff, 50 councillors, and a turnover of 16 million. Coming back to the question, I'd argue strongly that actually we don't want to go back to the normal. I think one of the issues we've had over the last two or three years, and it seems to be continuing, is almost permanent turmoil. Not only have we had COVID, we've had Brexit, we've had all the political upheaval more recently. And there's a term I read about earlier this week. It was called permacrisis, which is that we're looking at that being the norm. And we've had, you know, the 20th century was pretty much the steady economic growth. But there were lots of reasons behind that that are no longer in play, and therefore we're going to be in a different position. So I'd argue that we can't go back to what was there before. What we need to do is find out what was good before, what opportunities, and COVID has offered a whole range of opportunities to look at things in a completely different way. And what is that new way of us leading our lives, running organisations, running businesses and so forth? So,
where about you, Cathy? How is the new normal for GM?
So I'll set context again. So I'm the Chief Resilience Officer within Greater Manchester, which means I lead a lot of our resilience, emergency planning, response, civil contingency services. And I think for me, some of these terms are quite difficult. I think if you were to talk to a lot of people, the experiences from COVID are still very real for people and they're ongoing. And I think I'm not sure we have achieved business as usual or even a new normality. You know, we're still seeing challenges in our healthcare systems. There's challenges around our economy. We're still keeping an eye open for variants of concern. So COVID hasn't gone. And so I think we're still in a state of flux. And then when you add in the context of the cost of living crisis or problems with energy, war in Ukraine, then you really do have a whole set of circumstances where it's very difficult to say, if we just take COVID and look at it, we're back to business as usual. So I think we're still very much in the recovery phase. And I know we'll come to talk about that, but I certainly don't think we're at the end of the recovery phase at all.
What about you, Mayor? What do you think? Your circumstances are totally different when it comes to recovery.
Well, what we lived, we felt that COVID drove the world to a reset, whereby it's a one-way ticket. There's no, we do not feel, if you look at the city and how the city encountered and lived COVID and post-COVID, we feel that there's a new norm now. And just if you look back at 2008, when the global financial crisis hit the world, and there was no back to normal. There was a new norm in dealing with risk in general, in finance. Same with money laundering and after 9/11, and how money laundering moved from being a cosmetic into an integral part of any financial institution. And now we're talking about COVID and how resilience is like a word whereby it's the core of every organization, of every city, as far as I'm concerned. I do not feel that we're getting back to normal. I believe, we are in the process of recovering, but with a new norm, indeed. And this entails a different mindset and extra cost in certain areas and challenges on the society because you cannot run a city without having commitment and loyalty from the society to take the movers of any success story to face a similar disaster in the future.
I'm hearing that we are not there yet. We are still in the process. So from your personal experiences, what has been achieved thus far with regard to recovery, or what were the major obstacles in recovery during this period? Cathy, you want to start off?
Okay. So I think certainly from the Greater Manchester perspective, we started to think about recovery as we started to respond. I mean, and that's a framework we would take into a lot of emergencies. And that asks us to think about the bigger picture and all the different factors that are impacting. So we were trying to understand the experience of our communities. We were trying to understand what was COVID different, you know, impacted people differently. You know, it really highlighted problems with inequalities, deprivation, some of the urban spaces where there was a lack of access to green space, problems with digital inequality. So right from the early days, there was starting to try and get that understanding and then start to address some of those issues. And some of it was done very quickly. You know, we start to put in support for access to digital online learning for children who aren't in school, for example. So you've got measures like that that go into place. I think certainly in the UK, we have the COVID-19 inquiry that's underway now. And that for me is really important because we can talk about recovery, but we have to understand what we've learned, you know, what happened and what we've learned. And I think that we're still in that space and it will take time. And I think part of that is about listening to people. So certainly the inquiry is inviting people to share their experiences and their views so that we get a richer understanding. And I think for me, recovery, I mean, it's got to be a space where we grieve and remember. It's got to be a space where we learn. And that isn't finished yet. And then it's a space where we move forwards. So I've probably drifted very slightly from your question there.
But I
wanted to bring out some of the processes that I think are ongoing.
So a clear distinction between immediate response and recovery, still in recovery, learning exactly what is needed and being the priorities essentially when it comes to communities and people, and especially the vulnerable people.
And still understanding the impact. So there's a changed pattern in terms of going to work. And that has impacts on our city centres, on our transport networks. We're still understanding the impact on people who are in education. And so actually, there's still the consequences of COVID are still unravelling.
Andy?
I agree with what Kathy said, but I guess I'll come at it from a slightly different perspective and look at it from the organisation I was working in and also with the whole Essex system. From an organisation point of view, it rocked the organisation to its core. I think for me, one of the biggest things was impact on individuals within that organisation. And some of those teams, particularly environmental health, COVID finished and most services were able to take a bit of a breath and recharge batteries. They've just had continued and there are still issues of burnout. And if you look at local government family across, and it's happening in the health system as well across the country, one of the impacts has been a really negative one because a lot of people have decided I'm going to take
time off
or retire early. I'm one of them. And decided that actually, you know, I want to do something different. And therefore, there's been a huge memory, experience and knowledge loss out of those sectors. And it's even worse in the health sector than it is in the public sector. So I think there's something. And one of the things that really surprised me was the reaction from our councillors. The council was fundamental to their life. They lost their social contact. Some of them, you know, were on their own at home and couldn't get out. They were totally frustrated that all the decision making suddenly was really, really difficult. And for about 2 months, I was the only one in the organisation who could make a decision because of our constitution and so forth. They hated that. They were very supportive, but they hated it. And so their whole rationale had suddenly gone for life. And there was a real issue around mental health in our councils, which was something I'd not even given a thought to. So I think organisationally, I think we all look, and it's the point Kathy made about the impact on individual, all of us living our lives, and we all were affected by COVID. but actually within an organisation. My main concern was actually the people within that organisation and the people we were serving, but the impact was huge. Looking at it kind of more in the Essex system, Essex is complex. It's 12 districts, 2 unitaries, 1 county, 3 CCGs, and the list goes on and on and on. So really complex system to manage. And I think the huge benefit that COVID brought as a byproduct was actually us working together was taken from, it wasn't weak, but it went from a level and went to a completely other level. So that was one of the benefits that it actually brought, particularly in the health and social care sector, where relationships were fundamentally changed. Obviously, we're not out of the woods on that one by a long shot for a whole host of reasons. But so they're just two. There's loads of things that did improve through the period, and there's lots of other examples, but they're just two I've put out.
Absolutely. From your point of view, Mayor, for your people, what has been achieved in terms of recovery and the lessons learned, if you like?
Actually, the elections that took place in April, whereby I was elected the mayor at the time, this April, so I'm like 7 months in office now, revealed a higher percentage of voting from the youth. So youth who can vote above age of 18. And this was never the case in my city. This was never the case. I mean, voting percentage did not ever exceed 37%. Now we're talking 45-47. And the gender and the engagement of women. I believe that the learning curve that took place as far as we are concerned from what we faced was highly driven by the youth and by women in my city, and for us was an eye opening, because before that the norm was what's in it for me, why should I go and vote, but during this election we felt that there was some kind of an appreciation to this engagement between the civil society and the municipality, living COVID and post-COVID. And I believe we did very well in noticing this this movement from the youth, especially the volunteers who really helped us much in reaching each and every house and household and even businesses, and playing music online, initiatives led by the municipality, distributing seeds and some plants and flowers and things to homes for people to plant and give them like small pieces of paper, how to do what, etc. So we were close. On top of that, we launched the new application for Ramallah Municipality, where people are closer. Actually, people became closer because of the financial sector is moving to cashless and paperless and touchless, etc. And people chose more to engage more with the municipality through the online platform and through the application. And this accelerated the level of loyalty and commitment to the city, to the citizenship, to be good citizens. For us was something worth digging deeper into, and it was a good positive impact that we quickly made use of. And now we are launching, after Christmas, we are launching the Youth Municipal Council. So we are going to schools.
You're building off from?
Absolutely. Yeah. So we need to engage back with them and get them back, get them involved with us. And And I'm changing the interior of the city hall at the reception area to have a very nice seating area for the youth to come, a very friendly environment for them to, you know, welcoming, and for the mayor to meet with the youth every month for 90 minutes to speak for 15 minutes and then take questions. So these were all big, we felt that these were positive signals from the public society that came out
of the COVID situation.
To build on, you know.
In your case, lessons learned from this whole experience?
Interesting you're talking about design of the council offices, because that's exactly what we're looking at from, because the way people work is completely different now. And certainly from, you know, my personal experience, you know, I've had 30 years in local government, but, you know, you were at work every day, and I didn't get a huge amount of time with my children. I was supportive, but work was a big part of my life. And actually, I think there's a huge opportunity to look at that kind of work-life balance going forward. And I'm pleased, you know, that most councils seem to be not like some of our national politicians saying you've got to be at your desk all the time. And actually having that balance of working from home and working in the office, I think is really positive. But that means a redesign of council offices completely, because when people are in the office, that's when you want them to be collaborating with each other, so with partner organisations,
relationships,
and so forth. So I think for me, that's one of the big opportunities and lessons that's come out of it, that I'm sure lots of businesses as well. But it's going to change the whole business growth market as well. So one of the big lessons that came out of it for us was around economic growth. We had a economic growth strategy for the district, which we thought was great, we're pushing on with. COVID ditched that overnight. And actually what came out of it, though, now six authorities plus the county council have put a North Essex strategy together. Some of the money we got from government to support businesses, we managed to top slice that to put it into a new economic growth strategy, which was all about inward investment, skills, business support and growth. Because it was one thing looking to bring a new business in, but actually you needed to protect your existing businesses. Otherwise, you know, the growth would disappear. So I think it was looking at things in a completely different way. And the council also achieved,
essentially.
We had a 4-year corporate strategy that was due to finish in 24. You know, the politicians very quickly said, well, actually, we need to look at what that says. And so we went through a complete refresh program through it, so that actually our plans changed fundamentally, which was through a consultation process with the public, the business sector and community sectors. So I think it was actually that speed of responsiveness as well, that actually you've got a situation in front of you which changed the norm completely.
Realising the need to change.
And it brought innovation and new thinking, and a freeing of thinking, actually. Not all the time, but actually there were lots of good examples like that.
Fantastic. Happy?
I think I won't repeat what Andy's just said, but I could do. So if I take it in a slightly different direction, I think one of the pieces of learning we're really trying to capitalise on is, we've touched on it, the response of the community. So, you know, similarly to Ramala, I think most people would say there was a really collective community level response to COVID. And I think it's something that we would really like to capitalize on, really. You know, there are other emergencies, you know, it's obvious they impact communities, but, you know, if we have flooding or something of that nature, if we, you know, can work in a different way with communities, I think that will give a better response. And we've got communities prepared in the room. And that's just one example of working with organisations in a different way to support people within the community to perhaps think about risks in a different way, and to perhaps think about how they prepare for them. And we're doing a lot of work with voluntary community sector colleagues to understand how we can draw all of that energy and skill and experience better into emergency response. And I think the other thing, to just touch on something different again, is that COVID, I mean, the world had seen something similar, you know, but going back to 1918,
maybe not to the
same, which few of us remember. But this type of systemic risk that touches every area of society, every area of business, has ripple effects all the way through everything that we do. I think we need to take the learning from that. In lots of ways, we were very agile. We saw the same innovation at points, the ability to respond very quickly, the capacity to design a very local response to meet the needs of local communities, things like the vaccination program.
Which was done very quickly.
Done very quickly. Lots of local innovation, local solutions designed within the national framework. But we need to understand these systemic, these wide-ranging risks in a much better way and understand how to respond to them.
So we'll come forward.
Yes, yes.
I would like to open it to the audience with regard to recovery, questions with regard to recovery or anyone who's online. Yes, please.
Yeah, John Huntle, I've been involved a long time. I first got in 1956 looking at shortage of nurses. I think you made a strong point about it's not a renewal of old things, and I would, you know, alter the word and put adaptation. It's very different, and I, you know, kept getting asked about the normality, and people were saying, no, it's going to be a different one. But I particularly worked with the NHS. I'm a public governor still with our foundation trust, and one of the problems is how we get over these changes to the public and patients. And some of you remember, I don't know whether you were here, but when there was a session at the business school on basically how humans judge machines, and with all this pressure about AI, technology, robotics, how do we get over to the public and patients that actually they're going to benefit? And, you know, at the moment, I'm not sure how quickly we're going to get rid of these waiting lists, how we get into this wider approach of focusing on mental health problem. So I would sort of see our big challenge is how do we get the public to understand what's happening and beneficial. There are lots of other areas you mentioned where the same. And what's interesting in terms of clinical and medical research now, the name's changing from impact research to transformational and translational research, particularly in the States, and that's what it's about, I think. But how do we persuade the end users in the health service that it's beneficial?
Thank you very much. We're going to touch on the second part of your question in a second. Yeah. Please, anyone would like to respond to the first part of the question?
I'm happy to give my views. And I can't talk specifically about the health system, but it's not my specialist area. But one of the things that we majored on through COVID was communication. Because actually residents, businesses in the district wanted lots of information. So we were sending newsletters out on a daily basis almost. And actually what that actually showed, we tried to put it in simple English and translate what was happening and tell people what was happening. Our satisfaction rates rose through that period by about 15%. So I think it's about the health system talking about, okay, what are the benefits that this is going to bring? On what, because it's all about, for me, it's all about how can you use AI in any, or whether it's health or anywhere else, how can you utilise AI to do a lot of the regular work and
generic
work that then allows your specialists to give more time in those specialist areas. And I think that's the argument that needs to be got across, that it obviously can need to be made more specific. So I think it is all about communication and conversations. You know, you were saying about getting closer to communities.
Yeah.
And, and I think it is about how do you have those conversations in a humane way, because AI is very inhumane, isn't it? And therefore, how do you converse in a humane way, but explain what the benefits are and why you're trying to do it?
Thank you very much. Any other questions with regard to recovery? Yes, please.
There was one question that you were talking about before. It was about basically your counsel. It was about how, like, it was basically you working at home and stuff, and that sort of question. And I don't, I disagree with it actually, because you said we should do more of it, but I feel we should actually do less of it, because, for example, let's say go to the library and the council, and just this is the council. More people are working from home, but there's an issue with, for example, the library, because within the library, there's less work been happening. The library is falling apart because there's certain sectors in the library that don't exist anymore because the staff don't want to work there and the staff don't want to help. And that comes from the staff directly because I've asked them. And it's like there's people who just want to work from home, don't want to actually work in terms of things. There's people who are more sense of, in since the pandemic, in the library, become more lazy with their council workers. So it's like...
I don't think that is the case. It's more of a system now that combines both, but anyone...
Can I come back? Because obviously I made the point, and I agree with what you're saying completely, and I had a range of services. So at one end of this spectrum, I had the waste service and the grounds maintenance service, 200 staff. They had to come into work all the way through COVID. And there's no way they can deliver their service without being in person. At the other end of the spectrum, I got my marketing team and a few other teams who could work from home all the time, if you allowed them to. And that caused quite a tension in the organisation, actually, when you were talking about, well, what's the business model going forward? My attitude was actually everything's driven by what the customer needs are.
Yep.
And we had certain services in the council where we had some real challenges with staff who said, actually, I quite like working from home. But from the organisational's perspective, they couldn't deliver the service from home. So I probably didn't word it very well, but it's about that. It's got to be driven by customer need, and there's got to be a balance service by service as to how much home working and how much has got to be in person. And in some services, and I'd argue, you know, my background's leisure services, you can't work in a leisure centre from home. So in a library, I'd say it's a person-to-person service. So,
and I believe anyone would like to add anything else? I think we've got one more question. Yeah. From our line audience.
So we have a question from one of our social media viewers. Please place any questions online, please, if you'd like us to post it to the panel on your behalf. But this one, simple for the panel, is, has there been a particular area or country that has been a good example of building resilience in the wake of COVID-19?
Do we want to answer this question now, or shall we wait till we get to the resilience part of our discussion?
Thank you.
So I want us to continue with the renewal aspect. And looking at the research that we have done with the RRR project, one of the things that was significantly highlighted was this need for transformation, the need for change. And I think all three of you touched upon as a subject. I want us to start with, how did you realize that there was a need for change, and what were your immediate priorities of changing? Which I've started.
We felt that COVID triggered and drove transformation. We felt that life after COVID became faster. People are not willing to wait more on the queue for health reasons. People are not willing to call at the municipality. They want things virtually, be done virtually. So this quickness, this faster and quicker. And here I'll come to, for example, digitization, e-signature, especially when you're talking about government and quasi-government institutions, whereby electronic signatures and all these things, they have its own legalities and the challenges, and it's not easy to apply technology on areas that touches on the public sector front. However, we feel more response now from, for example, the union, the architects, whereby all the plans need to be signed physically, and the plans need to be printed on paper and delivered, and then signed, and then get back to the municipality. It was an initiative from the union that they want to apply, they want to enforce the e-signature law, which was issued back in 2017. However, it wasn't active, it wasn't applied. Why? Because of legalities and the all legal aspects that the government insists on having a live signature. But now we feel that there is this compromise for the sake of getting things done faster. And this was, again, not an option.
Is it compromise, or is it more adaptability?
As far as they are concerned, it's a compromise. As far as we are concerned, indeed, it's an adaptability, and it's excellent. Yeah. It's very good. But when we, for example, my city, the municipality, Ramallah municipality, always had like new ideas and new initiatives and lobby locally, regionally, and internationally for changes on all fronts. However, we still get stuck with some many. Legalities that are in place, and you know, when you talk to the public sector, it's not easy to change. And this is the norm that is becoming a norm of resisting digitization to now accepting it for the sake of getting things done faster. And this was, I believe, driven. This transformation was driven by COVID. Basically, by the demand force, the people, the citizens, who are calling at a change, an immediate change, and they just say it's because of COVID, and then the prime minister say,
so it has become the forefront of the change.
Yeah. Before that, it wasn't an option.
Yeah, immediate priorities for GM.
Well, I think. I mean, there's a question about how do you recognise where change is needed?
Exactly.
I mean, when COVID started, we started to collect a lot of statistics and data to try and understand the impacts. And, you know, we were looking across a whole range of things. So, you know, this was a public health emergency where we were teaching people really about infectious disease control. You know, I think a lot of knowledge about infectious diseases probably waned over the years as they become less prevalent. And suddenly there we are, you know, trying to teach people again. It'd be interesting to see how much of that stays with the population. You've then got COVID. The lockdown was a very blunt tool in some ways. You know, it really changed everybody's life. And I think in Greater Manchester, we experienced periods of lockdown for longer than a lot of other areas in the country.
Correct.
And some areas of Greater Manchester in particular. So you started to see that disproportionate impact of COVID on communities. And then you've got the changes in how we worked and how we were delivering services. So a lot of those immediate priorities at the time were about whether it's protective equipment, you know, so that people can do their jobs, whether it's about innovation in healthcare, vaccination, you know, whether it's about supporting people in their homes. And lots of that has not been lost. You know, lots of that is
the learning that
built
we carry
in.
Through, yeah.
I think the other thing we are doing is those public health services. We talked about it earlier, but we worked as a whole system. So Greater Manchester, you know, we've 10 councils, a combined authority, a healthcare system, 10 acute trusts, but then we've got all the integrated care boards on top of that. We were working with our police services, fire services. You know, one of the indicators we were monitoring was, for example, domestic violence and the impact of COVID on that. You know, we were putting into place a whole load of immediate support to people. And that way in which the public health emergency brought the system together is something we are still building on and looking at how our public health services can be designed to have strengthened surveillance, communication. The piece about communicating with the public, we were running, and we still are, we call them behavioural insight surveys. So we're surveying groups of people all the way across Greater Manchester to understand how people feel and how they're behaving, not just about COVID now, but about other challenges. And so that is helping to inform the measures that we're putting in place.
Absolutely.
And lots of it, I mean, the digital transformation that we picked up on, I mean, that's a huge agenda and really important going forwards. And I mean, there will be longer term changes that I know you want to
Absolutely,
pick up on
yeah.
later.
The points that I'm picking up here is data-driven decision-making, essentially, collecting information and acting accordingly, short-term, and it seems like there is a need for long-term changes. Was it the same for the Essex Council?
I think probably the biggest lesson that I remember on the 20th of March when Boris at 5 o'clock said, we're going to lock down from 12 o'clock. I was sat in my office with my marketing officer and we looked at each other and thought, oh my God. And one of the first decisions I took that evening was we just did a quick survey and we needed 150 laptops because I got 150 staff who were using desktops. I then thought, oh right, so we now can't have council meetings. Okay, what does our constitution say about how we run the council? And I didn't sleep that night. You know,
did you say anything about Zoom?
No, didn't even know what Zoom was. And literally, I've got councillors who didn't know how to turn a computer on. But what happened in that next 2 weeks?
Remarkable, right?
Absolutely remarkable. And I'm sat there thinking, why can't I turn an organisation around that? Because I can spot there's a problem there. We did it in 2 weeks. But normally that would have taken 6-9 months, probably. We'd have had consultative committees here, there and everywhere. And that was the big lesson. And actually, it was trying to harness that to give staff the permission to actually look at things.
So empowering people.
Empowering. And it actually, there were things that, you know, managers came back to me and said, we've been doing this for so long. COVID blew it out of the water. And they said, well, I don't know why we're actually doing it. Never mind, why should we, you know, how are we doing it? And so it did create a bit of an innovation culture. And I have a horrible feeling we're tiptoeing back into older ways because that's natural. But it was that power of being able to bring transformation into an organisation was really, really powerful.
So how do we maintain that innovation? How do we maintain that culture of let's get it done together and let's move quickly? So how do we maintain that within your organisations or in your city that we are shifting towards the end of it?
Well, for me, it is about... it's about the leadership of the organisation and the empowerment. And it's, you know, my job was to translate politics and what was the manifesto requirements and then deliver that and then get the team, you know, the executive team, understanding what that political what those political priorities were and how could we deliver that as efficiently and effectively as we possibly could. So I think the process of COVID did leave a fundamental change, but it's for the way the organisation's led going forward to make sure that you don't just fall back into old ways and actually you keep that progress. But you need the teams to own that.
So we're talking about journey. Leadership, change of culture and the role of people.
Yeah.
So it plays an important part of the whole process, right?
Yeah. We chose to listen more. We felt that the public the citizens are closer to us, and it's the right time for us to reciprocate. and to get closer to them, and to listen more. And this was, and this took so many different shapes. Now we took a decision whereby groups of citizens can register online to attend municipal council meetings. This wasn't the norm before, but now we have space for 25 seats. So every Tuesday at 5, you can call at the municipality and listen to the, so this will, and they can also put a remark at the end and not engage in the discussion. And the idea is to listen to people. Because before COVID, people were not interested. People just wanted the service here. And the municipality after COVID does not only provide the classic vanilla service that any municipality provides, but it engages more in culture, for example, deeply in culture and in making good, loyal citizens in so many different shapes and forms. And the idea is to engage with the public by listening to them. We thought that this has been very, very successful. And as I'm reading on my Facebook page and on the Facebook and the social media pages for the municipality, the number of engagements is like, I would say, like 37% higher since last September, which is amazing.
Amazing, yeah.
Which is amazing. So people, just sending, and people now, they send me messages. Good morning, Mayor. We just noticed this and that. It's nice. I mean, it gets you closer
motivated
to people, and it gets, of course. And I believe in after 4 years, I bet you that the number of people who are engaged in the elections in my city would be like double, because people want to have a stake in this change, and they want their city to be, the same and better, and they want to be part of this change.
Yeah.
So listening to people, this is one of the
key points.
Key points indeed.
I'm going to say something slightly different.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm going to say it's very difficult, I think, and very challenging to keep up that level of transformational change. And it's partly because within many of our organisations, there are particular processes and systems that we bring into play in emergencies. And they allow for you to move at pace, at scale, to be agile. But they come, despite having checks and balances in them, they do have risks because you're not putting in the same level of checks and balances. Some of our processes are sometimes appear very slow, but it's because they are trying to be very consultative, very considered, very democratic, and there are lots of checks in the system. I think actually maintaining that pace and level of transformation is very difficult. Having said that, COVID, and there's many other examples, absolutely demonstrates that when faced with an issue, the system can be very innovative and can come up with quite different solutions. And so it's giving them space. And I think there is more willingness to listen to those different ideas and to bring them forwards. And I think, as the mayor touched on, COVID brought people together in a different way. And so we are certainly, if I just pick our work with the voluntary and community sector, for example, working with different organisations in a different way brings different ideas, voices, perspectives into the room. And so that starts to really enable change and to do things differently, as well as capitalising on all the differences that COVID has brought. But I'd actually say it's quite difficult. Emergencies allow for change in a way that is difficult, if you accept it as a business as usual. it's really difficult to maintain that pace and scale on business as usual.
So I'm hearing from the three of you that there is the culture is there, the people are there, the leadership is there, the processes are there, but sometimes it can be rigid, not because we don't want change, but because this is how it is. But can we actually say that there is agility? Can we actually say that our way of system, or our way of working is agile, and we are adaptable, and we can put forward long-term and short-term change?
I suppose the answer is yes, but it's about consistency across the system, because I think what COVID brought home was actually what I call whole systems leadership. So if you'd have been a district council chief exec 20 years ago, you were about running that organisation and the services that that provided. These days, that's not what district council chief, you do that. But actually the bigger job is actually how do you integrate with the business sector? How do you integrate with the community sector? How do you integrate with the health system? How do you integrate with the blue light services? And so it's actually about shaping the total lives that local people lead. And actually COVID actually brought that system together in a much more coordinated way and started to highlight where you could help. So I remember getting called to a meeting where the health and social care system were talking about how they could improve the system of discharge from hospitals, which was one of the major issues. And you kind of think, well, as a district council, I'm not sure what I could bring to the party. But actually, by going to a range of those meetings, then things started to, pennies started to drop. And then you were actually going back to these services and saying, actually, what can you do to help? And actually, things then started to fall out. And I think for me, it's about how do you create time to build those stronger partnerships, because that's where probably the bigger efficiencies and more impactful efficiencies on people's lives sit. But you don't create that without putting time and effort into it, and you can't guarantee that that time is going to result in an actual, which in the political world we work in, that politicians want certainty about, if I put resource there, I'm going to get output here. Yeah. And so that's a complex piece of work, but partnerships need time. And that's where I think the gold sits.
Yeah, so capitalizing on the social ties and the social networks that you have. Mm-hmm.
I think there's a little bit of a danger in COVID is that it united people behind a single issue. And I think, you know, go back in time, I'll go to the Commonwealth Games now. I'll just mention those. But again, when this city hosted the Commonwealth Games, the level of innovation was extraordinary, because to a certain extent, the teams working on it were focused on a time-bound single issue. And I think that of itself promotes agility. I think you are seeing adaptability across your public services. You know, as people are looking for new ways of doing things, there is the different ways of working from home that we've touched on. Don't want to repeat all of that. Are we as agile as everybody would want us to be? I think we bring forward new ideas, new perspectives, that we are trying to solve problems all the time. But it does take time. It takes investment of resources, of people. And I think outside of COVID, you're spreading it across multiple agendas.
Fronts, yeah.
You know, you might be trying to look at climate change. You might be looking to try and solve air pollution or transport issues. You might be looking at new ways of delivering energy solutions. And so you're dispersing people across a wider set of agendas. And I think that is not about not being agile or innovative, but it's going to slow the process down to a certain extent.
So it's the availability of resources and being able to allocate accordingly. And in your case, Mayor?
For this particular thing, we felt that we became more practical, like the private sector, and this was part of the change. I feel that the private sector today is very close to the municipality, and there are lots of projects that were never there before, and now they are popping up. From their end, they want a reliable partner, and from our end, we start to think outside the box. We had to. I mean, we cannot continue with the same pace before COVID, and having became like more practical in the sense and faster and engaging in digital transformation and insist on that to be our destiny. I mean, for us, we cannot, as I said, it's like a one-way ticket. We're not going back. It's like a new norm. And we felt that this change, there is a partner, a hidden partner in this change, who are the private sector. And the PPP is now popping up to the surface, and lots of initiatives are coming up. And this, I believe, the coming 5 years will face higher partnerships between the public and the private, which are a proof that organizations on both ends, I mean, private and public, choose to continue and faster through this transformation to take a new level, which is like the post COVID status of running the business and of growing the business, and this is hard to imagine when you're in the public sector and in the private sector. I mean, you cannot compare, but with COVID and post COVID, you feel that the private sector are becoming more cautious, and we're becoming more practical. I don't want to say we're risk takers, but we're becoming more practical. In the sense, yeah.
Final question with regard to chains: have you identified what needs to be done in the long run, long term change that eventually will lead us to resilience?
I think the interesting bit for me is the burning platform. Because the consistent bit is with COVID and you know, the Commonwealth Games example, and there's lots of others that actually, when there's a burning platform that everybody has an end goal that everybody agrees with, that's when you're in that kind of powerful position, because everybody's pulling, and it's how do you create those burning platforms, or, you know, so which comes back to, for me, is what are the important things that we ought to be doing. And the health and social care is the big one for me, because in this country we haven't, and a bit controversial now, but, you know, we haven't dealt with the health and social care problem, and it just keeps being kicked down the road. I spent some time in Denmark a few years ago, we're looking at their local government system there, very different system to here. But we walked into their equivalent of the local government association offices, and the first thing we saw was a room with 20 beds. And the first question when they given their presentation from one of the guys who was on the course with me was, what's the beds all about? And actually what it was several years before that, they decided local government needed reorganisation. Well, how many times have we tried to do that in this country? They'd actually brought all the stakeholders into the building and locked the doors and said, you need to redesign the local government system before you leave the building. And 5 days later, they all signed up. A month later, the legislation was passed, and 12 months later, local government was reorganized in Denmark. It's not as simple as that, obviously. But actually, if you look at health and social care, it's such a difficult subject.
Do you think it would be enjoyable to lock Boris in a room?
You know, it's, but it, it's that burning platform where you actually get everybody pulling in the same direction. Is that that's what we need to try and find on those key difficult
issues. Solutions, yeah.
So I think we know what some of the long-term changes are. I will still say we still need the outcomes of the identification of lessons and the learning, and I am sure that will produce much more. I think we are really clear that the disproportionate impact in different communities, we have to tackle inequalities and unequal health outcomes across our communities. We've got to tackle that. We've got to look at our urban environment. You know, there were people who were really struggling to get outside, you know, because they didn't live near the green spaces and the parks. And we need to look at how we're designing our urban environments. And I think if you actually look at the root causes of COVID, it all becomes very interesting, because some of the thinking is it's potentially linked to climate change. And then if you start to bring in that agenda and talk about the changes that we need to make there, they're significant, and the whole world is challenged by that. So I think we do know some of the long-term changes that we need to make, sometimes within our city or our community, and some of them are global. But that doesn't mean they're all going to be easy to pull off.
Right, and we have to listen to learn more in order
to
identify what needs to be changed in the long run.
Yeah.
Any questions relating to transformational change? Yes, please.
Thank you so much for interesting discussion. There's a huge literature in management, economics, and strategy, and coverage. And especially after the financial crisis, the 2009, I'm touching on some of the questions that they have raised here. I wonder if there have been any bridge to draw that rich literature and use of the lessons in practice. So, the feeling that I have sometimes under discussion is that some of these basically efforts are started from zero rather than drawing on the literature that we have. So that's my question. Has there been a bridge between the practice and the research that we do in the university to improve on the practices that we have?
I can easily answer that question.
Can I look quite enthusiastic about that question?
I would like you to take the question about the synergies between academia and practice.
I'd like to pick that up because I think that's something, you know, in Greater Manchester, we are blessed with a whole number of world-leading universities. And I think as Duncan said in his introduction, University of Manchester actually sit on our resilience forum. So, and we've co-designed projects and have taken them forwards to try and both learn from the academic research and thinking that has already taken place, as well as to look at some of our more immediate problems and say, if we bring together practitioners and researchers, can we produce something, a different outcome? So I think that bridge is there. We recently drew down some of the government's innovation funding to work with the University of Salford. And that was an interesting project there about how we communicate risks to the public. And then the next stage would be taking that into a much more dialogue space. So definitely in resilience. And if I look at some of the wider work done by the combined authority, they're absolutely pulled together academic experts and experts from other fields when we're faced with some of the really difficult challenges in the cities. It's been done around the economy, the environment, inequalities agenda, to make sure that we don't start from a, I won't say a blank piece of paper that doesn't recognise all the thinking, the research, and all the consideration that's been given to that topic already. So I'm not going to say that we can build even stronger bridges, but certainly the way that the universities in the city support the work that we do, I think is really helpful. And even the Duncan signposted the consortium that's been set up. So that's with nearly every resilience forum in the country. And that's about bringing together academics and practitioners with also people from the community to look at how do we take this issue of community resilience and build it and strengthen it. So I'm quite sorry, I wanted to jump in there because the answer is bridges are there.
Beautiful. Definitely, yeah. And a lot of the things that we're discussing today are driven actually by the results of the RRR project that we conducted. And a lot of the application implementation of the resilience framework for the consortium is coming, driving from drawing from existing literature knowledge.
I'll just quickly answer that because I was asked to chair the recovery group in Essex. And I said there was about 40 different organisations. I was co-chairing initially, but then finished up leading it on my own. But I kind of considered University of Essex to be kind of the conscience on my shoulder. And actually, the product we finished up delivering was extremely different to what if we'd have just ploughed ahead ourselves. So the role that the university played, and that was not just playing through Essex, it was playing through the greater southeast area, which was the regional area we were working in, feeding into governments as well. And it was a very different product that we finished up with and process that we went through, which will, you know, be a lasting legacy in the emergency forum in Essex. So that link with academia was crucial in terms of helping us think through what was a very challenging position.
Let's go at the back. Yes, please.
Thank you. Mr. Walton, Greater Manchester Aging Hall. A lot of our work is focused on the impacts of social isolation. My understanding when you talked about shared experiences, feeling socially isolated was something that I think we could all probably identify with at some point during the pandemic. And I think, you talked about those community coming together and that happened. But I guess I'd be interested to know from the panel's got any reflections on whether that focus on social isolation, how is it going to play a role in our renewal and resilience? Because it feels like it was something we were talking about, and in terms of being resilient communities, being connected to each other, does that have a place in either or both renewal and resilience?
Anyone? Thank you.
It's really hard when you look at how the society reacts to regulations or to instructions. Take an example of the lockdown and the people how they perceive lockdown and this resistance. And yet. I feel now that we really learned a lot as a municipality, as a local government. I mean, on how to approach people in times of disaster or in odd times. I mean, choosing the words and the approach. Even the body language. I lived days whereby I had to freeze a smile on my face, because people, they get reacted immediately with how I react to things or to problems when we're living a disaster, especially in a small city like Ramallah, who's already living under occupation and living under extreme hot circumstances, put aside COVID. But I felt that that this isolation was we took it in a very friendly way when we offered the public schools for the people to use it, and for the municipality other buildings that we have, we offered it to the government for vaccination and testing, etc. And we went to people's houses and we took it in our own buses, and we went to their places and disinfected them. So we were close locking them down and isolating them was really bad, and we felt it after they left. I mean, in 2021, when people went out and saw facts on the ground and how this huge irreversible change to their lives and businesses, and even in schools and behavior of children. I mean, my daughters at home, I mean, I could not, and still until the very today, I cannot reverse things, because I feel that the relationship between, for example, a family, father, mother, and children becomes more what we call sans façon, because they've been locked down together for a longer time, and this attitude is reflected back in school. So locking them and this isolation was really bad, and I feel that there has been lots of lessons that we learned and will be learning more, and that's why we decided to establish a new department at the municipality. It's called social inclusion, whereby we address people, I mean, senior citizens, business people, all sectors in this respect. Yeah.
Thank you very much. I was involved for about 5 years in discussions of the Greater Manchester Health Service about sharing electronic records. And everybody said what a wonderful thing it was and how we ought to do it. And nothing happened until COVID, because we had information governance all over the place. Suddenly with COVID, it all happened overnight. And now we've got shared records, and that's great. Why did that happen? That's about the perception of risk, isn't it? I mean, actually, it's very dangerous not to share medical records. It was dangerous before, but suddenly people saw it differently. Do you think the pandemic has changed the way we see risk? And maybe in a good way? I mean, do we need more pandemics?
Definitely not. But maybe risk management, the way we perceive risk?
I agree in lots of ways, because things did change that needed to change.
Yeah, it should have changed lots.
And the question is, but I'm not sure. I think actually things are going the other way, certainly from a local government sort of view, because you'll have all seen nationally that there are several local authorities that are in severe financial difficulties. And it appears that what's going to happen is actually the regulation and inspection from central government is going to increase. There's talk of the audit commission coming back, and therefore audit arrangements will become more and more. And therefore, actually, I can see it becoming more restrictive and local authorities having to jump through more hoops, which actually then moves you in completely the opposite direction of being more responsive, is my reading of the current landscape, which is a shame, because it does need that balance. But it's difficult when it's in a political situation. You know, if as a chief executive, if I said I'm going to deliver a project, but there were risks in it and then didn't deliver it, my conversation with the leader to say, actually, we were going to do this, it's all gone pear-shaped and we've done this, I'll probably be out of my job, you know. So in working in that political world does make that risk dynamic different to being in the private sector.
Can we get a couple more questions from the live audience?
Yeah, thank you. I think that would be great. I've got a question here which really is reflecting on the discussions today. It's from a colleague in the British Red Cross. And the question is, the panel have highlighted that we're in a new normal, which I think we all can relate to, but as others have said, many of the resilient response space are exhausted due to the volume of work during and after COVID, which the panel itself has referred to. This is then in addition to all the multiple overlapping, ongoing, concurrent crisis and emergencies, which we've collectively responded to and are also having to anticipate, of course, in the near future. So the question is, what are the panel's views on how we move out of that constant further crisis, I think is the term used earlier on, into a more sustained way for all concerned?
Touching upon resilience.
I think it probably does take us into the resilience space, to be honest.
Please go ahead.
So a segue there. I think it is difficult because I don't know how easily we say we move out of a sort of permanent crisis situation, because the way a lot of things that are influencing us at the moment are global. So it's the way the world is working and changing. And some of them, you know, are challenging to anticipate, and very difficult to understand what the fallout will be. So even if, you know, something like the war in Ukraine had been foreseen, the impacts that it's then having across the world are potentially much more difficult to understand. And perhaps it's always been so in a way, that the world has always changed and evolved, and we've always had to respond to that. And I think there's lots of the ways we think, our cognitive biases that we have around emergencies and risks. You know, we don't always look back, you know, in a factual way. I mean, this is where actually the conversation about academic research is really helpful, because, you know, you need the evidence base when you look back. But if I think about my time in local government, which spans quite a long time now, we have constantly been adapting and changing as we've had technological, political, environmental challenges to deal with. So I think in some ways, I accept that treating everything as an emergency and a crisis is probably not sustainable, but accepting that there will be a constant need to evolve, adapt and change, actually, I think that's something we are going to face for a long time.
And that might be the way forward.
Yeah.
Another one, David?
I think it's somebody's reflecting on a comment that Andy made about mental health, local elected members, which is always an interesting one, Andy. But the question is, do you believe that increased investment on the government's level, I assume that's national government, in mental health services and support is fundamental for change, renewal, and overall societal resilience? A very broad question, I understand.
It's a very broad question, and I think it's a very simple answer. And the answer from my perspective is yes. You know, I think mental health services are in a really difficult place with demand going up and dwindling resources. So it's one of those difficult, complex issues that needs investment. So,
absolutely. I'm conscious of the time. I just want to touch upon a few more aspects of resilience. So all the changes that you have implemented thus far, or the plans for change, are for leading to resilience. What does it mean to you? What does effective resilience mean to you? And how can we get to that state? Kathy?
We're part of two of the global resilience networks in Greater Manchester. So we share membership of the Resilient Cities Network with Ramallah. So, and we are also a resilience hub within the United Nations Making Cities Resilient 2030 programme. And both of these programmes have slightly different but complementary definitions of resilience. If I take the Making Cities Resilient 2030, that's particularly looking at urban resilience. And I think that definition, if I use that one for the purposes of this conversation, focuses us particularly on disasters. So what are you being resilient to? And in that space, we're looking at disasters, or we tend not to use that word in the UK, so emergencies. And it looks at both the response, but also this concept of disaster risk reduction. So how do we embed thinking about risk into every decision that we make? So, you know, to take that in public authorities, do we think about the impact that our decisions will have on risk? And to take some examples around that, it talks to, that's governance about our decision making, but it talks to how we do planning and spatial development. You know, where are we building? Do we expose people to natural hazards? And if we do, do we take action in how that environment is designed to protect people? Are we investing enough in the environment and our green infrastructure? And in a different environment, I'll talk to you about moorlands around Greater Manchester, which massively protect us from a whole range of emergencies. It also asks us to think about our institutions. You know, how much are we investing in our institutions to ensure they can cope with the unexpected when it's thrown at them? And therefore, are reducing the adverse consequences of risk? And it takes you through communities and other areas. So the point about looking at disaster risk reduction and the way that making cities resilient is taking it is about saying it touches all aspects of what we do. And it is about thinking about those decisions that we make. Are we actually reducing or removing risk? Are we managing residual risk? And are we creating risks in what we do? And do we understand those? And so that's one of the definitions. You know, the mayor may wish to touch on the Resilient Cities Network. So, yeah. But that's the Making Cities Resilient approach to resilience.
Your take on it?
I think for me, I'll pick on a couple of examples, I guess. One of them is a positive that in Essex, one of the issues we had was with the Essex Resilience Forum through the whole pandemic. We'd never had anything that lasted more than 2-3 weeks where the ERF needed to meet. All of a sudden, we were going for months and in fact years. And resourcing of the Essex Resilience Forum, there was one full-time member of staff. And so it was the partner organisations who were then having to basically second people in, which fell particularly on the blue light services, the county council and the two unitary councils in Thurrock and Southend, because at district council level, we weren't of a suitable size of organisation that we could just let them have a marketing person, because that would have halved my marketing team and so forth. So, but the positive out of that is the government have now invested in the resilience forums so that actually they will be much more, have dedicated staff who can then work with all the partner agencies in terms of improving our response, training exercises and so forth. So that's been a huge, one of the other challenges, somebody mentioned this evening about public health and lack of investment. I read a figure this afternoon, actually, that was produced by the Local Government Association that actually has shown that since 2015-16 in this country, there's been £1 billion reduction in the amount of investment in environmental health. And I know in my council, we've cut the team twice in the last 5 or 6 years. And that's come home to play, because when we actually needed that specialism to deal with COVID, we hadn't got the environmental health specialists. And I think environmental health have been the one service, certainly in my council, that have really struggled with the demands on their service and time. They've done a sterling job, but actually it needs significant investment. And when you see the national picture around where local government funding is going, how you square that, I really don't know. So it is, for me, the point Cathy made, it's about your corporate plan and being able to deliver that. I think for all local authorities, we've had a wake-up call about, well, in putting your corporate plan together, how much are you considering the resilience side of things? And I think the honest answer is probably not enough. So it's certainly in our case, it wasn't.
And what about societal resilience now? Let's close with societal resilience means for you and how can be achieved.
Ramallah believes that that resilience, for us, resilience is like it's our destiny. We were privileged to join back in 2017 Resilient Cities, and this is one cornerstone in our I don't want to say success, but we managed to live COVID and to challenge enorm, I mean, COVID, and pass through it. And that's because of the commitment towards a resilient city concept. And for us as a municipality, that is other municipalities in Palestine are 80% financed by government funds, whereby the government collects the property taxes and they pay the municipalities. However, Ramallah, 65% of its revenues is already generated from within the municipality. And this actually started back in 2017 when we noticed that, yeah, we have to be more resilient and therefore we need to manage our own resources, etc. I would like to close by saying in resilience, and to touch on the point where the gentleman now mentioned about risk. And I believe in risk and resilience, we're proactive. And in internal control, we're reactive. And I believe today, if we want to be more resilient, we need to touch more on risk versus internal control and to anticipate risk, the multiple risks that we live through COVID and post-COVID, which work as far as we are concerned on strengthening our resilience.
And I would like to close by saying that I hope that this experience has created the skills and the know-how and the experience, the learning for being ready for the next big adversity. So please, a big round of
special thanks to the speakers. I know I was sitting there, they just thinking about all the aspects of our lives that have been impacted in different ways, and really thinking hard about the issues of what collaborations have come out of the experience and how people have worked together, and hope that we don't lose on that going forward. But thank you very much for everything that you've offered to us. It's a great
pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you found this episode insightful. For a list of our latest webinars, news, and useful business content, please visit ambs.ac.uk.